Accession number 30623, reel 7.
Accession number 30623, Mr. Terry O'Leary, reel 7. Now, so what were you doing in the St. Austell? Oh, well, first we've got this first rum ration then. Yes. Tell us about your rum ration.
Well, I had my 21st birthday on 21st September 1945. That was my birthday, and we were anchored in Malta, off Malta, in the Grand Harbour, I think. And you had Liberty boats going ashore. And the thing to do in Malta, there was a place called The Gut, which G-U-T, but its actual name was Straight Street. And all it was rather a wide alley with steps going up, ascending up to a high point. And on each side were bars and eating places. That's all it comprised of. Bars, eating. And so the ideal run ashore was, when you got ashore, if you were visiting Malta, you had to go up the Gut. If you hadn't been to the Gut, you hadn't been to Malta, never mind all the churches and that were very ornate and nice. You had to go up the Gut to say that you had been up the Gut. And in one of them, again, unfortunately, there were so many, the name escapes me. There was one chap, very effeminate, but definitely not homosexual, but very effeminate. Used to have blonde Marcel waved hair. Used to wear a blouses with these large sleeves. And he had cards and with a photograph of himself. And you would go into the bar. He would be there walking around. Oh, he was drumming up business. That was all he was doing. And he would sit down. You'd offer him a drink. And he would give you a card and ask you what your name was, and then write, "All my love, Sugar." That was his name. He was known as Sugar. And again, that was one of the things that you, to say you've been to Malta, you had to have one of these things of sugar. There was another bit of competition from a guy called Bobby, who was black-haired, but, you know, Sugar was the guy. Big fellow, I mean, he was about over 6 foot. I understood he came from Gibraltar originally, and a hard man, but dressed, you know, tight trousers and these blouses with these large sleeves, and it didn't seem to do anything, sing or anything. He just sort of wandered around drumming up business, like, you know, "Would you like another drink? And if so, I'll sit here and I'll have an orange, orangeade. And then when you bought your aid, he would give you this card and say, you know." It was all part of the scene, I suppose. But, yeah, then, of course, I got changed from T, temperance, to G on my card.
You haven't told me about the first rum ration yet. I think you got diverted into the...
Yeah, I'm sorry, yeah.
So what happened with your first rum ration? Well, was there a story to it, or was it just...
No, it was just the fact that you're 21, you're entitled to your rum ration. So when...
How was it issued? Because there's quite a ritual about it all.
There is, it? Yeah. What happened was the killick, or the leading telegraphist of the mess in our case, the killick is an anchor that they wore to show they were a leading seaman. They would take... what they called a fanny, which was a metal dish with a handle. They would have to go and they would pipe, 11 o'clock I think it was, over the tannoy, "Up spirits." And once the word "up spirits" came, he would grab this fanny, go up, and they would know how many of his members were entitled to grog. So, you'd probably get 11... or 10, whatever the number was, issues of rum into the one container. All that very, very pussy. I mean, it was done with chief petty officers there and officers all watching the fact where this went. And it was, for us, it wasn't neat. It was two and one. For every tot of rum, and you only got one tot, they added two tots of water, watered it down. And so it became quite a measurable, really, if you weren't a heavy drinker, quite a measurable amount of rum. And if it was your birthday, you would get what they called sippers from other members. Like they'd say, "Oh, it's his birthday. Hey, I'll have a sip." And a sip, it was sort of a routine which no one ever took advantage of. A sip literally meant a sip. What came after that?
Gulpers.
Yeah, gulpers, and then sandy bottom.
Tell us what, well, gulpers is...
Gulpers is two sippers. And sandy bottom meant you were allowed to see off what was ever was that they had handed you. That was called sandy bottoms.
And when would you get this? Was that for favours as
well? For if you did someone a good turn, cleared up the mess deck on his behalf and looked after some of his gear, because if it was left sculling around, as they called it, it would go into the scram bag. And the scram bag was where a bag where any kit that was left out was dumped. And you had to pay, in old days, you had to pay lumps of soap, because you had pus's hard soap, to get it back. But sometimes you just paid a couple of coppers, like, and that went into the mess fund, you know.
So you'd have these various two. So did you end up drunk on your 21st?
Oh, no,
you didn't
God,
have a lot of sippers.
No. I'll tell you why, because later I learned there was an Admiral, so I understand, an Admiralty fleet order that wouldn't permit anybody giving anybody else part of their rum, although, of course, it still went on. I understood what happened was that there were twins in Gibraltar, and being twins, everybody was lashing them up to their rum, and one of them died of alcoholic poisoning, and the Admiralty Fleet Order came out that no one was to accept rum from any other party. But you just had your rum, and you could tell when the rum had come up, because, you know, the talk would get a bit more boisterous, and because they're only youngsters, and, you know,
it did affect you a bit, though.
Well, I think so. I think, yeah.
Did you like it?
I have a top every day now. Still, I've got a top ration there in that captain's
it was something you got into pretty quickly.
Passes rum, yeah. Yeah, it was a tradition, naval tradition, up spirits.
One thing about the importance of personal cleanliness, I mean, you were taught it, we didn't really go much into it when you mentioned it, though. And also, this business of sharing hammocks, but can you just talk a bit about how important it was?
Well, the cleanliness, very, very important. Very, very, very important. You had to make sure that your dobing, which was your washing, you did, especially in the med or out that area, was all white. So they had to be very meticulous washing your whites, and that was done in the ablution area.
Is it still done in the bucket?
In the heads. In the bucket, yeah. In the heads, you know, where in the washroom. Your hammock had to be laid out. But not altogether. Obviously, you looked in to see if anybody was doing it. If no one was there, then you could do it. And scrubbed with Pusser's hard soap. You had to scrub that. The covers of your mattress or whatever they called it then, that went in your hammock, that had to be removed and cleaned regularly. And the biggest thing was the washing of your white blanket. That was a horrendous task. But you were allowed at various times, because we're post-war now, aren't we, to take it on the upper deck and dry it on the upper deck, because cleanliness was next to godliness in the Navy. I never heard anybody who was smelt foul or had lice, or it was very, very... Well, they used to say that... you know, anybody that did would be thrown overboard at night if they were caught, being dirty. But of course,
what about the showers? Was that we had showers?
We didn't have showers. No, no.
Was it Batson?
I think we had. I can't remember. All I can remember was washing down. I really can't remember showers. I really can't. Perhaps we had them, and just became part of the routine. I can't recall. I can remember the amount of water in the washroom. It seemed to be always sort of afloat with people dobing, but I can't recall showers. Probably they had them, but I really can't recall. All I know was that you washed regularly and kept yourself clean.
What about the heads? What were they like?
Well, just like ordinary heads, except they had no doors on them, and you know, so you were sort of doing your functions in view of everybody. But that was.
Did you soon get used to that?
Oh yes, yeah. It didn't. Things like I found myself acclimatizing to things in the Navy quite easily. Yeah.
So tell me how you got on with your shipmates.
Oh, well, I didn't meet many of them, you see, because you were from your mess deck up to the wireless room. If you could have a loaf, as they called it, on the upper deck behind one of the 4.5 gun emplacements, sunning yourself. But for meeting other members of the crew, I didn't.
Were you seen as slightly superior being... communications staff? Or?
Well, we thought we were, but they thought we were. It's a different matter. I do recall once we were still burning signals on HMS St. Austell Bay, even though the war had finished, and you had to go down to the boiler house where the they were oil fired and not coal. And I remember getting the biggest rollicking I ever had in my naval service. When you went down there, there was two doors because the boiler house was kept at a pressure, was pressurized, and there were two doors and it had a glass disc in it. And you looked in. When the inner door was closed, you could open the outer door, get into between them. Once you had closed the outer door, you then open the inner door, which kept the pressure. And, I mean, I was quite ignorant of all this business, but I was told to take these signals down to the chief stoker, who would dispose them in the boiler, or in the furnace. And I went in, the door looked closed to me, because I'd been told about it. I opened the door, and I felt a rush of air, quickly closed this door, went down, and the chief stoker gave me the biggest rollicking because I hadn't ascertained what I should have done is pushed a button if I thought the inner door hadn't been sealed properly, and it could have caused what they call a flashback. I know nothing about it. I'm only going by what he told me, which could have severely burnt anybody standing adjacent to the door of the furnace. And he rousted me for about 10 minutes, and so I always remember that situation, yeah, because I thought, God, I could have been responsible for burning a few blokes, but I didn't know.
Did you make any special pals amongst actual communications ratings?
On board the ship, three of them, yeah, there were three chaps who... one was a Scotsman, and the other one was this guy that was always seasick whenever we put to sea.
And why did you pick them?
I don't know. You just sort of look around for anybody who looks, you know, as your sort of likes and dislikes, I suppose. Books to read, and you know, pass books to one another that you've got softbacks and.
What about with the NCOs, it's the Navy, what about the petty officers the Killicks and the petty officers? How did you get on with them?
Well, I didn't, you know, I mean, I kept a low profile and I never got charged any time I was in the Royal Navy or in the any other service.
But the petty officers, I mean, would they be the ones you saw most of running the signals of the wireless officer?
Yeah, but when you was on watch, there was always a duty petty officer on there and a... Right, pardon me, chief petty officer and officer, radio communications officer.
Did they know the stuff?
Oh yeah, yeah, very good. Because I mean, some of these guys were regulars, not HOs like me. You know.
What about the officers? How do you? I mean, you
didn't meet many of them. One lot I recall in Gibraltar, where we were coming back ashore in Gib, which after we left Malta, we went to Gibraltar in the St. Austell Bay, and there was these three officers in front. Although it was dark, we could hear by their voices that they were officers, and going back to our ship, and one of them picked up one of these oil drums and threw it in the dry dock, which made a terrible clattering noise. And I was surprised to see that on default was next day, he was weighing off people for coming back being drunk, which rather surprised me. I can recall sort of thinking to myself, my God.
Like, what about the skipper? I mean, all the
didn't see much of him. He used to do rounds. Skipper, you just cleared up for skipper's rounds, and he would come round. I think I'm not sure how frequently, but he would visit the ship, make sure all the mess decks were clean, and then you had the officer of the day. He would come round to check that all the mess decks were clean.
So he didn't make a big impact on you?
No. I say, it seemed to me that all I was doing was working, going from the radio room back to me forecastle when we were...
Now, so what about... So you moved to Gibraltar?
Yes, we went to Gibraltar, and from there...
What was it like at Gibraltar?
Yeah, quite good. I mean... everyone spoke English, and it was...
what was it like ashore?
Quite good, plenty of bars, and which are still there, because I went back the year before last. And, you know, all with various names, Ark Royal, they had names of naval, they seemed to be more navy orientated. So, yeah, we used to get...
And what exactly was the ship doing? I mean, the war's over.
Ah, that was tied up then. But then, what we were doing then, we then became a weather ship, an air sea rescue. And we were working from Gibraltar down to the Azores. We used to go down towards the Azores, reach a pre-designated area about a mile square, switch off the engines... and then drift, and once we got out of our mile square designated area, the engines were switched back on again, and we steered back into the centre of this. And what we were doing was sending out a radio beacon for aircraft coming from America to Europe. And we used to we had this operated by one of the guys, I don't know what his rank was. And he would be transmitting this on a predetermined signal, and the aircraft flying would use us as a landmark. So they'd pick up this beacon, get the biggest or loudest sound, fly towards it till it got louder and louder, then they would see us, and once they saw us, they would then use us as a beacon, alter course for Europe. And then we did, I think we did a fortnight of that, and then a week back in Gib.
And did you actually do any of the... what about the weather ship part?
Well, I don't know what they did, but they were sending messages back, cumulus cloud formations to Admiralty. I understood that was where it was all going, like, yeah.
But that's not part of... You didn't notice that much?
No, I didn't, but that was the object of the exercise, sending back forecasts of weather approaching... coming from the west to...
And did you ever actually rescue anybody?
No. No, we never, because we never saw anybody crash. But American aircraft would and did on occasions. Once they got over us or saw us, they would come in low because we were in contact by radio telephony with the skipper. We were on a frequency pre-arranged. And our skipper on the bridge would insist on having their tannoy turned on to the bridge so that he could talk, and he would ask them, you know, various questions about what they had on board. I remember one saying he had about 12 whacks, which didn't mean much to me, but I understood later they were American women army, people. And they used to fly, and they would fly the length of the ship, come in, across the forecastle and drop a bundle of newspapers and magazines, which, and very good too, they used to land smack on the forecastle, bounce right up to the breakwater, and then there was a bit of a scramble to get them opened up. And
anything else? I mean, you go out there quite regularly.
Yeah, I say every 3 weeks. We were out there for a fortnight, back into Gib for a week, where we were just going ashore, cleaning ship, and you know, all the jobs that one does when in harbour.
Tell me about cleaning ship.
Well, we didn't do much of it because as long as radio room was spick and span and the mess deck was tidy, I mean, we never painted ship or did any of the arduous tasks that the able seamen did.
Now, what happens next? How long were you on the ship? You joined her in August 45, just as the war was coming to an end, really.
It ended, wasn't it? And then we went from there, we went up the Adriatic we went into Taranto, Venice. In actual fact, while we were in, then Trieste. And while we were in Trieste, a ship was a merchant ship had lost steerage way, and there were port fleet tugs went out from Venice, and the first one who got a line on the ship got money. What did they call it?
Salvage.
Salvage money, yeah, that's the word. And so, of course, there was a bit of a rush to try and get the first line aboard, and we fortunately got that, and I got some pay about, must have been, certainly while I was in the army, but it went to my home, I got some money, not a fortune, you know, a few pounds, but...
which is quite a lot then, though, but you've not had much to do with it, really.
No.
You were just there.
Yeah, and chasing down from Trieste to try and get a line. Saw the ship and they put a whaler over the side to get alongside, get a line on and tow her back to, I think we towed her into Venice.
Anything else during the Adriatic trip?
No, I saw the results in what was the first place I said?
Taranto,
yeah, of that airstrike that the Fleet Air Arm had made, a giant battleship. Oh, it looked very big to me. It was completely upside down. The hull was still above water, and that impressed me, like, you know, to see it, because I hadn't seen a great deal of action, and that impressed me, seeing his hull sticking out of the water.
Did you regret the fact you'd not seen much
action?
Yeah,
I did, actually.
Now, tell me about that, because that's quite... Because some people dread it, some people want it.
No, I think that's probably the thing why I didn't go back in the Navy, because I didn't feel that I was really in the Navy. The Navy to me was cruisers, destroyers, battleships, and getting to know all the crew, and I never had any of that. My things were short stances, mostly shore stations, and that didn't strike me as being the Royal Navy. You know.
How long were you on the Austal, St. Austal Bay?
I was on the St. Austal Bay, let me think now. August 45 to February 46, now, so not too long.
So, anything else happened after the Adriatic thing?
We went up to Trieste, and that's where I left the St. Austal Bay. And I was told that I was going, because my number had come up. You had numbers, and when your number came up, you were going to be demobilised. So prior to that, they had to get you home ready, so you were at home when your number came up. And I was told that I was going to be demobilised, and I was going back to England. And I was asked if I fancied, would I like to go back on Medlock, which was an army route from Italy back to England. I don't know what the word stood for, Medlock, Mediterranean something, I suppose. And so I said yes. So I went back by train. Instead of going all the way back to Malta, all the way around to Gibraltar, I, in fact, went by train across Europe. The first stop was Villach in Austria. I remember that by train, where there was a big transit camp for the army, very big. And we had no eating irons, no knife, fork, spoon, or anything. And I remember being permitted, along with some other Matlows who were with me, about eight of us, I think there were, to go to the head of this queue of about 200 to get victualled up, get our food, which I thought was rather nice. Yeah. and they gave us their own mess tins and that, so to eat the food. And then we were able to sling our hammocks in the guard van, and so we weren't sitting on these hard seats that we'd been on up to like slats up to Valak. We were then at our own hammocks and got our heads down in the guard van, and we went back across Germany. I remember crossing the Rhine. I remember being in Lille because we were in a siding there for a while. Then we went to Dunkirk and then went across by, I think it must have been ferry, I don't know what, I can't recall the transport, to Dover. And it was the day we landed, I recall, that there was a big lot of people, or a few people killed at a football match when a stand collapsed. I can't recall what football club it was. It was one of the, I think it was the first or second division football club, but one of the stands collapsed and a lot of people were killed there.
So it's about February 46, though.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the demobilisation process like?
Well, I hadn't got demobilised then. I then went to the Admiralty at Whitehall. I was
right.
I was drafted there.